Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. The United States is currently embroiled in actual fighting in Iran and in a battle for dominance in industries including automotive and AI. So, how do we stack up? Here's Tommy Tucker on where we stand against China in electric vehicles.
We're getting ready to talk about EVs, electric vehicles, with our friend Steve Melnick, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. Is China far ahead of us when it comes to EVs and self-driving cars, and what could that mean for the American automotive industry?
There was a recent article that appeared in New York Times, which I think did a good job of highlighting some of the issues. And what they pointed out very nicely is that China, especially companies like BYD, are really far ahead of the United States in terms of EVs. And it's not simply that they're building more. In fact, in 2025, BYD replaced Tesla as the world's largest manufacturer and seller of electric vehicles. But there are certain forces in place which are making, let's put it this way, which are helping China and its EV manufacturers really develop a competitive advantage. And the funny thing is, we've seen this game before.
How so?
Let me give you an example. I'm going to introduce you to someone, not even in cars. Ever heard of a guy by the name of Steven Sasson?
No.
Okay, good. I didn't expect you would. Well, they're making film.
Yeah.
And what Steve Sasson does is he's a researcher at Kodak, and he comes up with the first digital camera. And it's not really great. It makes a 1-megapixel picture using a Fairchild sensor. And Kodak is faced by this, and this is really a game changer. And guess what Kodak does? It basically sits on it. It doesn't want to do it.
Wow.
And to the extent that they figure that it was going to cannibalize sales of film. So basically, they pushed it aside. And what happened was, the assumption was, if you introduce digital, it's going to cannibalize sales of film. It's going to hurt us. But what they didn't understand is that if you don't do it, your competitor's going to do it. I see, the problem is, for them, they were locked in. Remember, how are you rewarded in most American companies? Look at the reward structure. I mean, there was a consultant friend of mine who's now passed on by the name of Ollie White, who used to say, you get what you inspect, not what you expect. That is, you get what you measure, not what you hope for. And he said, if you understand how managers act, look at what they're rewarded for. In the United States automotive industry, where do you think the bulk of your compensation is coming from? Stock.
Ah, that's right.
Okay, so think of it. Now, the logic of that is kind of simple. You want to align with the shareholders so that you do those things that help shareholders. So what could go wrong with this? Well, the problem is that locks you into a quarter-by-quarter mentality. So every quarter, you're only as good as the last quarter. So think of it. I mean, if you look at the compensation structure between the Chinese CEO and the American auto CEO, you see a really amazing difference in terms of how they're compensated. For example, in the United States, the smallest proportion of your base salary comes from salary. For example, if you look at the United States, basically $1 to $2 million for major CEOs comes from your base. Jim Farley, who's the CEO of Ford, his base salary is 1.7. Okay, so if you look at their total salary, which is what they get paid for at the end of the week, we're looking between 20 to 30 million. Most of that comes from stock options, from stock guarantees. So essentially, what you're doing is you're rewarded for improving payback, improving your EPS, earnings per share. So that's one reason why in the article it talked about the fact that companies like Ford, GM are investing in stock buybacks. Why? Because earnings per share is earnings divided by number of shares. If you want to improve earnings per shares, what do? You reduce the number of shares. How do you do that? You buy them back. That gets you so far, but the problem is it changes how you view investments. And that's not unique to Kodak. I'll give you an example. Okay, in 1976, Western Union is approached by this Canadian by the name of Alexander Graham Bell. Guess what he wants to do? He wants to sell Western Union the telephone. How much is he asking? $100,000. What's the President William Morton, CEO of Western Union, says, that's ridiculous. Who wants to listen to them talk over wire? Mm. Kodak shelves the digital camera in 1975. In the 1970s, in Xerox Park Research Center in Palo Alto, California, a young Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak go there and they see the graphic user interface. And this is really amazing to them. They see the mouse. Now, here's a company which has developed these two great innovations. And what do? They ignore them. Why? Because the profit they get from selling copiers is far greater than what they would get from selling these interfaces. Blockbuster in 2000 passes on Netflix. Bear in the late 1890s, is faced by this thing called aspirin, and they decide initially to pass on it. Why? Because they have a better pain relief medicine that they nickname heroin. And why do they call it heroin? Because it makes their workers feel heroic. And in all of those cases, the reason that they pass is because they're afraid of cannibalizing their existing sales. So what happens is you look at short-term sales, long-term. The thing I want to tell you is that if you look at the investment structure, we prioritize short-term over long-term. And if you compare that with what's going on in China in EVs, the Chinese CEO is making $2 to $5 million total. So think about that. That's one-tenth of what the American CEO is making in the auto industry. And what is he being prioritized on? Market share growth and technological progress.
It seems
so
like...
if you take a...
Go ahead.
Go on.
Well, I was just going to say, what you're saying is we're rewarding the status quo when everybody's protecting their own little fiefdom, if you will, of stock prices or whatever. And it's like, why would I change it? Why would I wreck this and mess with my compensation, right?
In 1990, three researchers from MIT look at the auto industry, and they try to explain why is it the auto industry in the United States is suffering relative to the Japanese. And one of the things they pick up is the time it takes to introduce a car. In the United States at that time, it takes about 7 to 10 years to introduce a car, a new model. And even when you introduce a new model, the first generation is, when I was growing up, the old line is, you never buy the first year model,
right?
Because it's got all of these bugs. Mm-hmm. And here are the Chinese, the Japanese, and they're doing it faster. They're finding out that they're doing it in under 3 years. So what they're doing is using competition. They're using these new model changeovers to give consumers the impression that what they're getting is fresher, better, and more importantly, cheaper. And what the Chinese are doing is they're using that same strategy. And it's a strategy I used to teach to my MBA students who wouldn't listen. So what happens is, take a look at what's happening in the auto industry. China is introducing new cars between 12 to 18 months. Mm. So in 12 to 18 months, you've got a new generation coming out. The United States is still 4 years. And one of the things that we've also learned from history is you don't treat a new product like a different version of an existing product. You don't treat the personal computer like the mainframe. And what the Chinese are doing is they're focusing on software. They're focusing on revising. For example, one of their cars is looking at the problem of how do you recharge itself. So what they've done is they've said, fine, you drive into one of our recharging stations, and what we're going to do is remove your battery pack and put a brand new one in. 20 minutes later, you're off with a brand new battery pack. They're re-examining it. They're doing over-the-air updates far more quickly. So what you've got going on is you've got something really fundamentally different. And that's why I said, when I looked at the article and I looked at the EVs, I'll say a couple of things. Number one, I don't have a lot of confidence that the American auto industry is going to be able to respond based on history. Number two, the Chinese are applying the lessons we taught them. The Chinese are doing to us what Henry Ford did to the auto industry in the early 1900s.
What it seems to me is that when it comes to EVs, we're running a race here, okay? And China had a three-lap lead. So we just stopped. We pulled into the pits now. But the race is still going on, and China continues to improve their lead. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Love learning stuff, and I always do every time Stephen Melnick's on, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. He is our EV go-to guy. All right, let's look at it as it exists with U.S. exporting cars to Canada, or I don't know if U.S. cars are manufactured in Canada. But what kind
they're
of
assembled?
Assembled. Okay. What kind of equation changer is this now with Chinese EVs being more friendly accepted in Canada? Would that be accurate?
Well, yeah. What's happened? First of all, let's understand what the treaty has done. Canada, under Mark Carney, basically, there have been some comments made about Canada, and Canadians, if you understand them, it's a small country, but it's very proud. And people get upset, especially when you refer to them as the 51st state. It's like Great Britain coming to the United States and saying, we think you should be part, you should come back and be part of the, you should be part of the Commonwealth. It doesn't work. So Canada has been reorientating its trading relationships, and instead of going north-south, it's gone east-west. It's built strong relationships with the EU, and it's built, it mended fences with China. One of the things it did is, as it mended fences, it signed a new tariff, a new trading agreement. Part of the trading agreement is lower tariffs on EVs. Okay, why is that so important? A lot of what we think about Chinese cars is based either on articles coming out from journals like the Wall Street Journal, where if you look at, I'll give you something to think about, February 3rd of this year, a woman who's the Chinese bureau chief for Wall Street Journal in Beijing has been driving a Chinese EV, and she says, I won't go back to American. So what you're going to do is you're going to introduce EVs at a significantly lower price, because previously they were tariffed at 100%, and that's going to allow Canadians to see, experience Chinese EVs and what they're offering. And what they're offering in many cases is really a compelling argument. Because of the intense competition amongst EV manufacturers in China, they listen closely to their customers. And there's a high frequency of what's known as OTAs, over-the-air updates. So if you have a problem, odds are it's going to be updated. And so what's happening, a lot of the criticisms, issues that we have concerns about, things like range anxiety, charging time, performance in cold weather, she points out that those are being addressed actively either by OTAs or by innovations. The other thing that they recognize, if you're dealing with a very, very fast-changing technology, you've got to price it differently. We price our EVs so that we try to get back, recoup some of the expenses. The Chinese are playing a longer-term game. They're thinking in terms of decades. And if you're thinking in terms of decades, you think differently.
Now on to AI. Here's Vanita Sacker.
AI, AI, AI. It's talked about. It's used. It's controversial. It's all those things. And the University of Minnesota wants to be at the forefront of it. The University of Minnesota has just launched a new AI hub, a university-wide initiative. Dr. Galen Jones, the university's first vice provost of AI. This is a pretty broad initiative, AI Hub. Break it down, and how does the University of Minnesota become on the forefront of AI technology and development?
We're going to focus on educating our students, staff, and faculty, developing AI capabilities in our operations, and doing a ton of outreach in working with industry and the community.
It's so broad that AI is really impacting every part, every aspect of our lives. Are there certain areas that you are focusing on?
One question I get very often is, am I going to lose my job?
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
People are worried about how it's going to kind of impact their work life. And that's a significant emphasis for us. We're already working with companies to help train their employees, to get them on the cutting edge, make sure that they stay relevant in the workforce. And it's those folks, companies across the country are reporting are in high demand. And so we're already working with about a dozen companies here to help in training and getting people up to speed on using AI in their work. And so I don't think it has to be that folks are going to lose their job. It's, you know, with some training, with some development, they can be even more productive than usual.
How has that changed in how you prepare students, no matter what area of study they're in, are adapted to the future of the workplace?
As they get into their majors and that sort of thing, there's going to be domain-specific training that's maybe more appropriate for, you know, what an engineer might need may be different than what a political scientist needs to learn. And so we're going to have to train people in what their desired career paths are. And we're going to have to talk a lot with industry to figure out what type of outcomes our students need to be engaged with in order to be employable in the workforce.
We're speaking with Dr. Galen Jones. He is the University of Minnesota's Vice Provost for AI. You mentioned it, ethics and responsibility. That's a big part of the conversation when talking about AI, not only in students, making sure that they're not using it to cheat in homework, but also in the big picture, that we make sure that AI is used for the good of humanity and not for the elimination of humanity. How much is that a consideration, and is that like even its own separate area of study on the ethics and morality and responsibility of AI usage?
Well, there's a huge research area in ethics and responsibility of AI. In many ways, it's not as far along as it needs to be. And I'm speaking globally now, not just at the University of Minnesota. And so there needs to be a lot of work in that. But I'll just point out a couple of areas that we're in particular working on. There's a lot of issues around AI's impacts on the environment, for example. And we are already doing research here at the university to lower its environmental impacts or to understand its environmental impacts and make it more sustainable. And so that's just one example of an area where we're kind of focusing on right now. Other areas include things like, making sure there's human oversight, making sure folks are using critical thinking and understanding its outputs. We all have examples where ChatGPT has hallucinated, right, and just made things up.
Yep.
And so we have to be careful about making sure that students and faculty and just everybody engages with it critically.
This is just a question for you as a person. When you look at the AI companies that are driving the development at breakneck speed, do you feel that they're doing a good enough job of ensuring responsibility and ethical usage?
The really big tech companies that are doing it, they do have some work in these areas. I think that this is a large problem that needs a really large effort. So universities have to be involved, industry folks have to be involved, government has to be involved in this conversation, not just around ethics or responsible use, but setting policy and making laws to enforce that.
Can you talk about the ways that AI is really being developed when it comes to agriculture? Farmers would be able to benefit from AI?
So it does. AI can be used to make better decisions about how to use fertilizers or pest control or, develop better strands or varieties of various, crops. So it can play a big role in improving agricultural outcomes.
Well, this is fascinating. Dr. Galen Jones from the University of Minnesota, the first ever vice provost for AI. Thank you so much for the time. And we'll continue to follow this because it's pretty much impacting all our lives every single day. And almost every single day, it affects us in new ways.
Let's leave you with an interesting thought. How much do you know about owls?
Carla Bloom, Executive Director of the International Owl Center. Forgive me, Carla, I had no idea that Houston, Minnesota was the home to the International Owl Center. And lo and behold, we are at the start of the Owl Festival. Now we know. What is the Owl Festival for guys like me who had no idea that we celebrate owls in this way?
Well, it literally started as a Hatch Day party back in 2003 for Alice the Great Horned Owl, who was an education bird I had, and then it sort of got out of hand from there. And we have people that fly in from around the country. We present the World Owl Hall of Fame Award, so we have some of the top owl people from the world coming and speaking. And we do everything you could imagine relating to owls and then some. So there's kids' international owl art from all over the world. We got almost 3,000 entries from 40 countries. It's amazing. There's a kids' owl calling contest, owl crafts, owl face painting, nest box building, pellet dissection, owl-themed food, believe it or not, around town. So if you go to a bar in town, you can get an owl face hamburger. If you go to the convenience store, you can get owl face ice cream. You go to the coffee shop, you get owl-themed beverages. You go to the Lutheran church, they're having an owl face pancake breakfast. The pizza place has owl-shaped pizza. There's owl merchandise. We have vendors coming in. And, of course, live owls.
Of course.
Live owls. And we bring in the Illinois Raptor Center, and they bring a live snowy owl. So that's a big hit.
Oh, yeah.
And usually a barn owl that will fly. So, yeah. And then there's, yeah, more than that.
Carla, what makes a Hall of Fame owl?
Actually, it's very difficult. We haven't presented, we present awards to humans and owls. We haven't presented an owl award for 10 years. So Flacco, the Eurasian eagle owl, is receiving it this year because everybody knew about Flacco from New York City when he was released from by vandals from his enclosure. So he brought huge awareness to owls, what's going on, discussion around, you know, captivity versus being in the wild, non-native apex predator being on the loose here. Can they survive in the wild? But very key for him, it's not just about the education piece. An owl that gets in there has to have had their toes or their talons in multiple fields. So just education is not enough. He got it because his death spurred legislation to reduce the use of rodenticides, which is one of the things he died from. So legislation, it can be, they can be involved in rehab, they can be involved in conservation, raising money for research, that kind of thing. But for him, it was the education and the conservation.
Well, congratulations. I know it's posthumous, but Flacco sounds a well-deserving as a Hall of Fame owl. Thank you so much for jumping on. I wish we had more time to talk, but we put you on the map, I guess.
Awesome.
Let's get
Thank
down
you.
To Houston and celebrate all things owls. Thank you very much, Carla.
Thanks for having us on. It'll be good weather. Come and have a hoot in Houston.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.